So the first part of the lecture was the classical treatment, which I do not like, and I'm afraid some of you didn't like either. So after the sadist part, let's come to a more pleasant part and turn to ordinary differential equations. There, at least, we understand, hopefully, much better what turns out. So, the Vlasov equation is a mean field equation for a many-body problem. Let's write the many-body dynamics. Trivial. You had the vector field, you know it. You only have a sum here over particles instead of the integral. That's all. Now, the Hamiltonian structure of this system might not be completely obvious. First, you can easily identify conjugate pairs for the particles, positions and momenta do the job, and further independent conjugate pairs will relate to the modes. And for simplicity, here I focus on single mode because lambda damping deals with a single mode anyway. And if you have a complex amplitude for a harmonic oscillator, for something oscillating, you have two natural choices for conjugate variables, either the phase and energy or action of the harmonic oscillator, or the generalized position, generalized momentum of the harmonic oscillator as well, which are related immediately with the action angle variables by this well-known change of variable. Incidentally, if you play with the actual Hamiltonian generating the equations of motion, then you must introduce a factor here, square root of n. Okay, you can do that. Now, to generate the equations of motion, you need to write down its generator, which is Hamiltonian. Easy. Three terms. First one, ballistic for the particles. We'll generate the first equation. Second term, action angle representation for the harmonic oscillator, just omega I. Trivial. Generates this. So the wave is a harmonic oscillator which oscillates at its frequency omega. No surprise. Well, we have to couple the wave which resonates in its cavity and the particles. Fine. The wave acts on the particles by defining a sinusoidal potential. So here is the trigonometric function with amplitude zeta, complex amplitude zeta, the modulus of which being the square root of I, fine, and the phase of which determining the location of the trough of the potential. So if you expand this term, you get the modulus here, minus I theta, and you see that the trough is at x equal theta over k. So the phase of the wave really tells you where it is. We know that. But if you use this set of conjugate variables along with this Hamiltonian to generate the Hamilton equations of motion, you end up exactly with the system over there, which has two more obvious features. First, there is a feedback of particles upon the wave, as it has to be. We have an autonomous system, and the feedback is in the source term here, which I have not yet discussed, but they really come together. You cannot get the force on the particle without having the source on the wave. Okay? And there's a second outcome. This Hamiltonian is time independent, therefore energy will be conserved. H is a constant of the motion. Good news. No surprise. Second, the Hamiltonian is invariant under some Galilei transformations. Okay, that doesn't play a big role in the whole story. But it is also invariant under space translations. If you treat the phase of the wave, theta, as a position multiplied by k. So, because you have this invariance under translations for the joint quantities x theta over k, you have an extra constant of the motion, which is momentum. And the momentum of the wave particle system is the sum of particle momenta, we know that, plus the pointing vector of the wave, which is, as we know, proportional to the wave energy. This second constant of the motion will really give us more insight in the dynamics than the energy. Also, in most textbook treatments of wave-particle interaction, people do focus on the energy. I'm sorry for that. Momentum makes life easier. Besides, you easily check by this conservation law that if the particle, if a particle gets accelerated by the wave, v of the particle increases, and therefore either other particles are decelerated or the wave intensity decreases. That is a major phenomenon. The particle and wave can exchange momentum, but only if the wave intensity is non-constant. And that is crucial. That will be the key to much of our understanding in a moment. Omega naught? Well, it's the eigenfrequency of the mode which you get, say, in the Euler picture already. It may be omega p. Yes, it's just a constant omega naught. And if you perform a Galilei transformation which brings you at the phase velocity omega naught over k, then you just set it to zero. That's a mathematical trick. You may not like it. I don't urge you to put yourself in this wave nominal velocity frame, but you can do so if you want. So it's just a parameter, omega naught, which tells you the eigenfrequency of the wave if there were no particle. Oh, sorry. I just misstated what I meant. Let me be more clear. The whole system we are interested in couples particles and, for the moment, a single wave. That wave is the one which will strongly interact with the particles. The usual picture you have, and I'm sure you've been practicing a lot, is that one. This is your velocity distribution function, maybe a big Maxwellian here with some characteristic width, vt, thermal velocity. And if you have several Langmuir waves in the system, you may indicate their intensities as a function of the phase velocity, and you would put your spectrum here. And because of the Bohm-Gross dispersion relation you have there to the left, in fact, the Langmuir waves have large phase velocities, so they come here in the tail of your Maxwellian or whatever. Therefore, the traditional picture you have, a la Landau, with Poisson equation, is to keep the whole Maxwellian and find small oscillations of the particles in this bulk, generating oscillations of the electric field, which you call Langmuir waves. And what I do, for simplicity, is forget about this, because the bulk particles oscillate so gently that they really play the role of the wave I'm calling zeta, and the price I'm paying for that is rather cheap. I'm replacing a large number of degrees of freedom by a single one, which is the wave with complex amplitude zeta. And that wave with complex amplitude zeta acts upon particles which might significantly interact with it, that is, in a range of phase velocities around, in a range of velocities around the wave phase velocity, omega naught over k. So this degree of freedom is essential to the picture. And if you want to come back to the more classical pictures, you must replace it by the many degrees of freedom of the bulk particles. And then you are done. You may forget about what I've been calling the wave. But it's much better to speak of wave coupled to tail particles. It will make the picture much easier to discuss. Does it answer your question? Thank you. So I shall return to this picture in a minute. Yes? Well, it will be the Comte constant. So it's related to the dielectric constant epsilon zero, to the charge of the particles, to permit to the susceptibility of the medium corresponding to this indeed. Yes, well, it's not the dielectric constant, it's just a lump of many things I don't want to discuss, but it gives you the coupling, and that's all you need. So, more questions? Okay, so now we're back in undergraduate mathematical physics. We can easily construct the analog of the reference solutions we had already in the kinetic picture. Zero field, put zeta equals zero. Particles propagating at constant velocity because of the zero field. So Vr equal V naught, initial value. Positions, linear in time with velocity V naught. Well, can we ensure that the field remains zero forever? That's not very hard. We only need the sum of trigonometric exponentials here to remain zero forever. That can be ensured if you put your particles equally spaced along the circle, because the sum of roots of unity is zero. So if you have two particles, you put one at phase alpha, the other one at phase alpha plus pi, the sum is zero. And you give them the same velocity, and they move forever, generating a destructive interference in the sun. But if you have n particles, you may organize them in several beams, each of them with its own velocity vs. And therefore, where the kinetic theorist had the following picture of a distribution function like that, what we do here is to put particles in x v space 0 to pi over k, and here I'll put a beam, say, with 50 particles. Well, okay, that's a bit many, maybe 4 particles. Here I put another beam very close to it with as many particles, equally spaced. And if I want to mimic a lower value for the distribution function, I space the beams further away from each other, or I put less particles on each of them. What I have in mind is to let the number of beams go to infinity, let the number of particles on a beam also go to infinity, so that in the large n limit, I really mimic a homogeneous distribution in space with that profile in velocity. But I do not need to have an infinity of particles in this picture. With a finite number, I can easily manage for this quantity here to remain zero forever, if I put the particles cleverly enough. Okay, so this is my reference state. The number of beams will be denoted by B. The total number of particles will be N. On each beam, you have NS particles. NS depending on S. Okay. Now you want to study perturbations of this multi-beam solution of the equations of motion. Since you need here the trigonometric exponential, it's natural to introduce a discrete Fourier transform for the discrepancy of the positions delta x for each particle and of its velocity delta v. That's not a hard job. You end up with new variables, A for the velocities, C for the positions, and the transformation matrix is a well-known elementary matrix, easily invertible. And in these new variables, after linearizing your equations around your reference state, you end up with this set of ordinary differential equations with constant coefficients, very close to what we had in the kinetic picture. The set I am writing here relates only to the case Kn here equal to the wave relevant K. For the other values of K, this is trivial. So completely uninteresting ballistic motion, which reminds you of the fact that there were so many ways to define your beams that, of course, you must have rather degenerate eigenvalue zero in the problem. But that's another story. It will not be relevant to our discussion. In fact, we've been very lucky here, because we started from perturbations of a time-dependent expression, which is here periodic in time for each beam with frequency kvs. And in the general case, we would have had, for the linearized system, a Floquet problem with several frequencies, the kvs, which might even be incommensurate. but life is nice, and we get, after Fourier transform, just this elementary problem. So here comes my second exercise, homework. If we have a single being, why not? That amounts to what is called in plasma physics the cold beam injected in the plasma. So you have the bulk of your plasma with the Maxwellian here, and then you excite, you inject a beam at a given velocity. What will happen? You put all the particles on the same reference velocity Vs. After Fourier transform in space, all that remains is a set of three ordinary differential equations. First order constant coefficients. That's an easy homework. So let's find the characteristic polynomial, or rather the dispersion function. So, well, again, my eigenvalue will be alpha, and the evolution equations read this way. There were plenty I's on the right-hand side. So it turns out that the matrix M is real. It involves the particle reference velocity Vs, and the wave nominal velocity omega naught over k, and that's all. And therefore, after elementary algebra, you end up with the same fixed point equation, sigma equals here sigma, with this function here. To go to the kinetic limit, or the continuous limit, you only need to replace the sum over S by an integral with weight and S over N given by the distribution function F naught. And that's all. So you really can translate the finite and calculations into the kinetic calculations. It's free. And why is it free? For the very simple reason that our dynamics was very regular. Our right-hand side was even much better than Lipschitz. It was analytic. Okay. So the good news is that the limit n going to infinity for the n-body problem is regular, and you get unavoidably the Vlasov equation, which has a unique global solution as well. And therefore, getting here the same expression is unavoidable. But we had some principal part or whatever unpleasant expressions. No, we just have B, the number of beams, double poles, and that's all. We have a simple rational function. That is, of course, much easier to study. And no wonder, because we have a finite number of degrees of freedom problem. So where are the roots? Write them again, omega plus I gamma. Then you get omega equal omega naught plus a detuning, which takes this unpleasant expression. I'll come out with a picture in a minute. And for gamma, the imaginary part of the equality over there yields gamma equal something times gamma. What can we tell about the terms in the sum? Well, definitely they peak in terms of velocities. The most important contributions will be for Vs close to omega. And evolution will be represented as a finite sum. For zeta, I just take the coefficients zeta sigma, which implies that for the velocity perturbations and the position perturbations, I get an extra factor, 1 over kvs minus sigma, and it's square. Which really means that if you excite an eigenvalue sigma close to some beam velocity vs over times k, then the beam at velocity vs will be more strongly excited than the other ones. That will tell us something about the physics. Okay. That's a nice pair of equations. We've got to solve them for real solutions, omega and gamma. That's an exercise in asymptotics. Not a very hard one. And in the asymptotics, because of the denominators, it makes a difference whether you let gamma go to zero in the limit, b going to infinity, or you keep gamma non-zero. If you let gamma go to zero, that's the interesting part for the analysis. You end up with pairs of solutions, gamma equal plus minus, the same quantity. Well, of course, you have pairs. You started from Hamiltonian dynamics. So the value here is proportional to the discretization parameter delta v up to a logarithmic correction. So that means that if gamma has to go to zero for b going to infinity, it basically goes as fast as the discretization of your distribution function. Whereas the corresponding frequencies omega take on values kvs, which means resonant right at a beam eigenfrequency, plus a correction also on the scale of delta v. Of course, this will not appeal to you very much unless you're very much used to it. I'll give you a picture in a minute. For the same price in the analysis, or slight extra price, you can compute for the initial value problem wave zeta equals zeta naught, particle perturbations A and C being zero. You compute the coefficients here, zeta sigma, which solves this expression, which turns out to be related to the derivative of E. And that's no surprise. So you have a cubic ball at places, and after a few lines of calculations, you end up with coefficient zeta sigma scaling like delta v as well, with a denominator gamma lambda plus I omega minus omega lambda. Omega lambda being omega naught plus a detuning, which I mentioned on a previous view graph. So basically, the coefficients you end up with are remarkably regular, and the fact that gamma lambda up is here comes from the fact that you have here a very regular sum of terms, all of the same kind, and the gamma lambda is what comes out from the sum. Okay. Then, if I look at the actual evolution of the wave, the outcome is, and we're very happy, zeta naught times a sum, well, this sum here, alpha being gamma plus I omega. So the sum becomes an integral in the limit of the continuum. So the exponential alpha t gives you exponential gamma t, but gamma goes to zero. Okay, forget about it. And omega remains alone, but you always had pairs, and therefore you had to add up the contribution from zeta sigma and its conjugate zeta sigma star. Adding up the two contributions is elementary algebra, which gives you the denominator here. So you have just this sum from zeta and zeta star, and that is a classic Fourier transform, which we all know. And it reads, if gamma lambda is negative, then this numerator here is positive, and you get up to the oscillation at frequency omega lambda, that's where the denominator reaches its maximum, you get just this almost exponential behavior. Well, almost, because it is the exponential of the absolute value of time multiplied by a negative coefficient gamma lambda. So, good news. Now we get lambda damping and reversibility for the same price. That expression is time reversible, and it damps when gamma lambda is negative. Moreover, you also get, for that price, the Fourier transform interpretation, which means you excited many eigenmodes, each of them with its own eigenvalue, gamma plus I omega, but you excite them coherently because these coefficients are remarkably related to each other. You only vary omega, basically, in the limit. So at initial time, you have your perturbation. You Fourier represented over all the eigenmodes, and the phase coherence, which you had because all the coefficients here, all the exponents here were zero at initial time, then after some time, some modes would have oscillated a little more than the others, and therefore you begin to get phase decoherence between the modes, or what we call in physics phase mixing. This is the essence of Van Kampen's argument, who formulated it in terms of the limit eigenmodes. What are they? Well, they are typically beam-like excitations supported by, well, the width of a mode was related to Vs equals sigma over k being small, so only the few beams at a velocity small to the phase velocity of the wave, or rather, phase velocity of the eigenmode sigma over k, are relevant. So, in the limit of the continuum, in fact, you excite for this beam what will appear as a small delta perturbation. For this beam, what appears at another small delta perturbation, or delta prime, actually. And therefore, what is initially a strong excitation by coherence between all these singular perturbations, singular objects, becomes a damped object on the global scale just because of phase mixing between the singular eigenmodes. That's Van Kampen's viewpoint. Case put it in a slightly more complete way. Now, I only told you half the story. I discussed the case of Landau damping. And we're happy. Here it is. But if gamma Landau is positive, the same calculations work. Now, of course, the minus sign comes in front. This is positive, and you end up with that function of time. Well, that doesn't look very much like an unstable object. Quite the contrary. If gamma Landau is positive, this object damps. So we certainly miss another part of the story. Before I turn to that part, let me illustrate the algebra. You can compute easily the roots of your equation sigma equals here sigma for a system, say, of 40 beams. So what do I show on these pictures? Three cases. For each of them, there are 40 beams in the velocity range from minus 2 to plus 2, that's normalization, and they are denoted by plus marks at their velocities. So in the complex frequency plane, I put k equal 1, velocity is frequency, they are just on the real axis. These plus marks indicate where the heave function has its double poles. Now, I'm looking for the roots of the equation sigma equals here sigma, and you may compute them algebraically, and these are represented by crosses like X. What you find is that many of them in the lower picture, all of them condensate along the plus marks. They come in pairs and they lie not midway but in between the plus signs for their real part. Now, the other point of interest here is the green point, which marks the Landau root. Obviously, what Landau identifies as a root is not one. It's far away from the actual roots. And it is just a construction. Now, the other lines, the continued line here is related to the real part of the coefficients 1 over zeta, and the dotted line, which you probably can't see very well, corresponds to the imaginary part, which tells us that the most important features of the theory already work for 40 beams. So this picture was drawn in the case of a negative slope for the distribution function. Good. What happens if you have a zero slope? That's a case I did not discuss in the previous part of the talk. I'm not going to discuss it right now. What happens if you have a positive slope? The picture looks very similar to the previous one, but the Landau root is over here, And next to it, you have a cross. Apart from that, there's little difference. Oh yes, the continuous line is always with the sign of minus gamma lambda, and that's no surprise. So that gives you more confidence on the calculations we made. And I must first discuss the algebra. For negative lambda rate, all the roots must have a vanishing growth rate in the limit of the continuum. Therefore, they are all discussed on the previous picture. So we are done. And this is the final expression for the wave evolution. On the other hand, for positive lambda rate, you have the opportunity of letting an eigenvalue have a non-zero gamma in the limit. And indeed, algebraically, it works very well, and you end up with the lambda eigenvalue. Well, you get two of them. The unstable one, which is the celebrated lambda unstable mode, and its twin, I should say its evil twin, with a minus sign, which damps, which I discarded when discussing the kinetic picture, but which really matters now. So what I get as an overall picture is that the time evolution of the eigenmodes will be the Van Kampen contribution, negative, always damped, positive and negative times, exponential. The lambda unstable mode and its twin. But here you have almost the same expression as here, or as there, depending on the sign of time. Algebraically, you just recombine all three terms in this single term, which gives you now not just the lambda exponential, but really the pair of relevant eigenmodes you find in Landau's analysis, one for positive time, one for negative time. This is what Landau tells you. What I've been telling you is that you have three contributions in the sum. The lambda one, the anti-lambda one, which, left alone with the lambda contribution, would give you this picture. That is, completely disagreeing with the original data for the initial value problem, you're off by a factor 2, but in agreement for long times. And the offset here is completely cancelled by the sum over Van Kampen modes, which gives you, in fact, sorry, they're not on that side, they're negative. What you're adding up is this term, which you were contemplating in horror because it had the wrong sign as well as the wrong time behavior. But that was a benediction because for positive time, the Van Kampen contribution kills the anti-lambda contribution. And in your right mind, when considering the initial value problem for the ordinary differential equation, you had to take the anti-Landau term on an equal footing with the Landau one. So the Van Kampen contribution plays a central role in giving a safeguard for the shortcut Landau treatment. Maybe I could summarize one algebraic aspect of the treatment. We have been discussing a dispersion relation for a while now. And the picture we keep in mind is really this one. So what we were discussing in the continuum limit was trying to find the zeros of this function, c minus sigma, which had that way, and df not being a shortcut for the integral, well, for the distribution function. But it works just as well when f not is not differentiable but just a stair function which is still a discrete probability. And in that case, you have the finite number of beam picture, which gives you a rational with denominator with degree 2b, numerator degree 2b plus 1. The roots you find are the zeros of the polynomial here, the upper one. And the poles are the zeros of the denominator. Now, you had B double poles, which were on the real axis. When you let N and B go to infinity, you increase the degrees of both the numerator and the denominator. And where you had a finite number of poles on the real axis, you end up with a cut along the support of F on the real axis. At the same time, the numerator provides you with more and more zeros, which condensate very close to the poles along the cut, so that seen from far away, you don't observe the cut so well, and in the unstable case, you are happy with a single zero, which is the Landau zero. But of course, if you have a cut in the complex plane, it's dangerous trying to make any discussion of negative time while watching the picture drawn for positive time. The fact that zeros accumulate near the poles, well, as well as they can, they still have to repel each other to some extent, may be reminiscent to some of you who might know it much better than I do, of Froissart doublets in the theory of rational approximation. So this is the algebraic picture which underlies the analysis with which some of you were already familiar. The good news is that with this finite number of degrees of freedom picture, you completely restore time symmetry, because you only have absolute values of time, and that's all. Besides, you also have actual eigenmodes, possibly many of them, cooperating or not cooperating, where the distribution function or approach would lead you to a continuous spectrum and a cut. So I hope that to some of you who will be teaching Lando Dumping to bathing students, this picture might be helpful. Now, this is not the end of the story, because for the whole hour, we've been discussing algebra. In the next lecture, I shall turn to particle motion, computing a little more about forces, trying to see where particles go. Right now, we just identified eigenmodes, so we know something is oscillating somewhere. Basically, the Van Kampen modes excite the two beamlets near the mode eigenvelocity. That is the main conclusion we have for the physicist. And tomorrow, I hope to show you more conclusions you can draw from the n-body approach. Okay, you didn't ask me too many questions, but have we still time for some? So, yes. Yes.
So therefore,
there is
nothing controversial.
Well,
if you are looking for the initial value problem and you have a solution, Lambda never says the thing he found is the initial
value problem. Lambda was clever, and I agree with him on that point definitely. Unfortunately, I'm not sure my students are as clever as Lambda is, or was. And they would like to call that eigenmode anyway, because it's so easy. It behaves exponentially. Okay, there's the wrong sign. There was that terrible stuff with analytic continuation. But we survived that, more or less. Sorry, speak louder.
Mm-hmm. It's like the same object, which means that, of course, it's not an eigenmode. If you look at some good attempts at following the wave, then it will be the solution.
Yes.
But
then those
are
Well, in a way, the controversy has been settled because we know that nature does show Lambda damping. We know that a Laplace transform solves an initial value problem, even if it's not an eigenmode. So when we're careful, that's fine. But when we're trying to teach Lambda damping, there may be problems. Among the problems, I would mention the difference between short-time and long-time behavior. We've been discussing a time evolution corresponding to this picture here, a Lavlasov. Incidentally, it comes from a numerical simulation with a semi-Lagrangian code. And the n-body approach would give you this, which is not so different. But for long times, n-body effects may cause a huge difference between the two pictures. And we shouldn't forget that actual dynamics are chaotic, nonlinear effects will come into play, and therefore, in this respect also, attacking the problem from another viewpoint may reveal some aspects of the initial problem. Because, of course, nonlinear effects had been discussed more than 30 years ago. And I shall come back to this also tomorrow again.
Okay, I have a much Krishna, Hare Krishna.